Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. You're tuned in to Columbo Chronicles at Blog Talk Radio. Follow the mover and shaker, award-winning author and host, seen on TV and radio, Rose Columbo. Every Wednesday, Rose interviews prominent experts and authors on politics and social justice. Call in and listen or ask the guests a question at 646-564-9742. Now, here's Rose.
Hi, everyone. Here's the Rose, Rose Columbo, and I'm right here for you at Blog Talk Radio, worldwide online radio, I might add, and you can listen anywhere in the world. I don't know what time it is in your country, and I don't know what time it is in your area, but I do know on the west coast of the USA, it is now 8:01 p.m. in the evening. So if you're a sleepyhead, welcome, because you're going to learn some really important information tonight, and it's entertaining and educational as well, because every Wednesday on Columbo Chronicles Live, we have very special guests, experts, authors, politicians, victims of legal abuse. It could be just about anything and any topic, from love to the mafia to corruption to family law courts to divorce to animal rights. And every guest is important and every topic is important because they all affect our lives. And tonight I'm really excited because we're going to welcome back a really special guest. And his name is Bill Friedman. He's an award-winning author, and he wrote the latest book, 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. And it's the inside story of the leaders of the four largest prohibition gangs who later ran elegant, illegal casinos across the United States of America. And before moving on to build 80% of the glamorous Las Vegas Strip gambling resorts, from the Flamingo to the 1946 to Caesar's Palace in 1966, and to the Bellagio, because that's where I was the last few days with family and friends celebrating a birthday. And it was very, very beautiful. I love the Bellagio, and they had the most beautiful peacocks. It looked like they were made out of roses, and it was just spectacular. And, of course, there's people from all over the world who visit Las Vegas, and people go there to see the shows, and they go there to just lay by the pool, or they go there to visit the clubs, or they just go there to gamble, or they go there to meet their family from all over the place, like we did, and that was really, really fun. And so it just so happened that I just got back from Las Vegas, and our special guest is going to be talking to us about Las Vegas. So don't want to miss this segment of the show in the world of authors and experts that will be coming up soon. So in the meantime, there's so many things going on in our country, the great USA, and around the world. It is absolutely crazy what's happening. All this political correctness and tolerance that brought so much devastation to the USA and Europe and Israel. Now, there's a breaking story about Judge Roy Moore, who was winning the Alabama election for a Senate seat. And suddenly Gloria Allred pops up, which is no surprise to me. anytime it appears that anytime a GOP, a conservative Republican, is about to win a congressional seat or a governorship or a senatorial seat or a presidency, Gloria Allred appears with some woman or women with sexual harassment allegations against the candidate. I have never, I can't recall Gloria Allred ever bothering with Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, or any other Democrat with sexual harassment charges, or allegations, I should say, allegations. But this story, she brought a young lady to light in the media against with allegations against Judge Roy Moore, who actually saved the Ten Commandments from being ripped out of the courthouses in the state of Alabama. And it says, breaking, Gloria Allred caught forging, get this, forging Roy Moore's signature in false accuser's yearbook. I mean, that's stunning, to say the least. And why would someone go to that extreme is just beyond me. It says, the now infamous yearbook signing that Gloria Allred trotted out yesterday, along with the accuser who gave the worst acting to come out of California in decades, has multiple problems that prove it to be fake. To start off with, Judge Roy Moore was not a DA. He was an assistant DA, and he would have not signed it as a district attorney. I think it's against the law to misrepresent yourself as a district attorney, period, for anyone. But as the Gateway Pundit points out, along with a plethora of social media users, there are a number of inconsistencies, leaving no doubt that the whole thing is a fake. Known for this insightful take on politics, journalist and author Thomas Wichter believes Judge Roy Moore's signature in Gloria Allred accuser Beverly Young Nelson's yearbook is a forgery. That sounds familiar. Remember Sheriff Joe Arpaio, Detective Zulo, and the forensic experts who allege that Obama's certificate of live birth and birth certificate certificates were forged and fakes, and whatever happened to that evidence? Anyway, it says, when pressed on whether he truly believes the signature is a forgery, Wichter replied, in my opinion, the signature is forged. The old Hickory House and date were definitely written by someone else, no question whatsoever. The sevens in 1977, to the right of Christmas, as written in the book, are very different from the sevens in the date 12-22-77 above Old Hickory House. Look at the two versions of the number seven, tweeted Wichter. 12-22-77 and Old Hickory House were written by a different person, he added. Next, Wichter points out the R and Y in Roy are not written the same way. The inflection of the Y is more pronounced in Moore's signature as Chief Justice. The R is noticeably longer in the signature of Chief Justice as well. So, this is a new and interesting allegations that are alleging that the signature of George Roy Moore in a sexual harassment accusation are forged. In addition, Wichter points out that the restaurant where Nelson alleges the incident took place was forged incorrectly. Old Hickory House in Gadsden was never called Old Hickory House. The person who forged the signature got the name wrong, claims Wichter. And the Ford signature also ends with, quote, D period, A period, quote, there's one problem. Moore was a deputy district attorney, DDA, at this time. During his legal career, Judge Moore became the first full-time deputy district attorney in Etowah County, Alabama, and served in the position from 1977 until 1982. In 1984, Judge Moore undertook private practice of law in Gadsden, Alabama, states Moore's bio on his campaign website. The accuser to this day calls him the district attorney. He was never district attorney. He was deputy DA. DDA, says Wichter. Then there's this. Who signs a yearbook in December? Now, I thought that was rather interesting. Who does sign a yearbook in December? On Monday evening, Judge Moore vehemently denied Nelson's allegations. Here's what Judge Moore told the press. Thank you all for being here tonight. Thank you to all the people who have come out at this late hour, and for being here. I want to address what's been brought out on television today by Gloria Allred. She's the attorney, and a client she has about things I allegedly did. I want to make it perfectly clear. The people of Alabama know me. They know my character. They know what I've stood for in the political world for over 40 years. I can tell you without hesitation, this is absolutely false. I never did what she said I did. I don't even know the woman. I don't know anything about her. I don't even know her. The restaurant is, or was. If you look at this situation, you'll see, because I'm 11 or 10 points or 11 points ahead, this race being just 28 days off, that this is a political maneuver and has nothing to do with reality. It's all about politics. But I also want to inject here that this is also a pattern. Remember Herman Cain? Remember the woman who was running against the Democrat Governor Moonbeam Jerry Brown in California? Remember Donald J. Trump, the candidate? Gloria Allred was all over all of these GOP Republican conservative candidates. And now she's after Judge Roy Moore with the same pattern. But where does she dig up these women? That's what I'd like to know. 10, 20, 30 years ago. That's amazing. What effect does all this have on the upcoming election? I have been more closely involved in Alabama politics than any other state besides Texas and even including California, says Judge Moore. Alabama is more conservative than Texas. Like Texas, Democrats in Alabama are not far left, many being pro-God, guns, and life. The more liberal Democrats get, the more they lose. Alabama Democrats have not broken 40% since 2000. It would take more than this to break that hurdle. They have lost by growing margins since 2000 on the whole. Alabama grassroots conservatives are also very active. It's front porch politics. I say this does more damage to the left. Any loss in votes will be compensated for in motivation to win. Alabamans are also very opposed to outside influences. Had a local paper broke this, it might have done some damage. The fact that this came out of D.C. not only limits in the trust factor, it is viewed as an intrusion. All these items factor into why the latest polling shows no effect from this. Any lost votes were made up with people on the fence, as shown in the latest Breitbart article. I do hope, no matter what the outcome, that Gloria Allred is brought up on forgery charges. Did she do it personally? I highly doubt it. But there is no doubt that she knew when she faced those cameras that the yearbook signing was a forgery. Allred has priors. And you can read this entire article. It just came out tonight, and it's joeforamerica.com. So check it out, and let's see here. Hold on a second. And let's get started with our very special guest. So let's take a break, and we'll come back to Colombo Chronicles Live right here at Blog Talk Radio, where you are free to speak up and speak out.
Keeping up with the news these days is like keeping up with the car. Well, you get the idea. There's a lot of yelling and screaming. Intelligent discussion, not so much. Ready for something refreshing, thought-provoking, and friendly? Okay, grab your favorite hot or cold drink, sit down, and listen to a friendly voice. The Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo on Blog Talk Radio. Every Wednesday night at 8 on the West Coast, or 11 for anyone sleepless on the East Coast, Rose Colombo welcomes dynamic authors and experts on a myriad of human interest topics. From politics to love, the environment, the mafia, healthcare, and more. It's 60 minutes of original entertainment and intriguing information with the top VIP guests. Senator John DeCamp exposing the Franklin cover-up. Dr. Tony O'Donnell, the herb doc. Dr. Alan Keyes discussing the White House. So, from Rose Colombo's home on the Colombo Chronicles Live to your home, Colombo says she doesn't want to have to send the familia to make sure you are listening.
Listening is an art. An art that humans are losing to the world of robots. Robots don't have any tone or human feelings. The addiction to communicate by texting isn't going away. People are feeling isolated, lonely, frustrated. People need people willing to listen to them. Can you imagine getting a text message that read, "You're fired," or "Hi, would you marry me?" It is happening. Colombo Chronicles is the option and the answer to human communication. Colombo Chronicles provides email access to your ideas and issues. Take advantage of this opportunity now. Go to ColomboChronicles.com. Click on subscribe today. Colombo is spelled C-O-L-O-M-B-O Chronicles. Fill out the form, submit it, bookmark and subscribe today. Remember the name, ColomboChronicles.com.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Yes, listen up, because now we're about to enter into the world of experts and authors on Colombo Chronicles Live with The Rose. And tonight's very special guest is a returning guest. His name is Bill Friedman, and he wrote the award-winning Depression-era true crime, All Against the Law. He wrote the groundbreaking research work, Designing Casinos to Dominate the Competition, published by the University of Nevada, Reno. He's also an author of the seminal book for succeeding in the casino business, Casino Management. He taught the pioneer course in casino management for UNLV's College of Hotel Administration during the decades of the 1970s. Mr. Friedman was president of the Castaways Hotel and Casino and the Silver Slipper Casino in the heart of the Las Vegas Strip for 13 years. He transformed them from perennial losers into super successes, consistently in the top of Nevada's highest profit per square foot performers. Mr. Friedman is president of the Friedman Management Group, which specializes in solving casino marketing, design, and operation problems. He has consulted for 40 years to casinos in the United States, England, Monaco, Russia, South Africa, Australia, Canada, and several Caribbean islands. And tonight he's here to discuss his upcoming book as well as his latest book, 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. And he talks about important, famous people such as Ben Siegel, Charlie Luciano, Frank Costello, and Al Capone, Frank Nitti, and so forth. So this is exciting, and he is a historian, and he is the expert on the untold stories of the gangsters who built the early Las Vegas Strip. And so let's get started, and let's say hello to Bill Friedman. Hi, Bill. How are you this evening?
Good, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm always excited to talk about your book. 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. It's a beautiful book, and it's presented in such an intriguing manner, and it's educational and informational as well, and tells so many untold stories that most Americans never heard before. And so I'm excited to talk about 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. So to begin with, though, for those who aren't familiar with you and your work in as a historian and a consultant, why don't you tell us how you even got interested in becoming a historian and a consultant in Las Vegas?
Well, my parents, when I was 7 years old, we lived in Oakland, California. They took me up to the our neighbors in Oakland, cabin at Lake Tahoe, and I visited my first casino, and I was totally fascinated with the dexterity of the dealers, and they used to let me stand several feet away from the tables and watch them every afternoon. And at a time when every young boy I knew wanted to be a cop or a fireman, I wanted to become a Las Vegas dealer, which even back then was a very tainted industry. And when I turned 21, I became a dealer. And Nevada had a unique development because it had no homegrown gambling industry. After it legalized gambling in 1931, every time they built a new hotel or expanded a casino, they'd have to reach around the country for illegal casino dealers and illegal casino executives, which were plentiful throughout America until the early 1950s. So most of the men I worked before when I dealt, the floormen and the shift bosses behind me, had come out of illegal gambling, and I was absolutely fascinated with these guys. Every night after work, I'd try to go and have a late-night toddy with one of them, and I'd sit and listen to their stories because they were on their own. They were the last of, like, the independent frontiermen, and they used to tell me how they'd buy protection from the police. And as I listened to them, and I always looked for patterns, I realized that while they bribed the police not to harass them, they really got no protection. They had an illegal business, and they couldn't call 911. If someone robbed them, if someone a gang came in to take over their business, they were all on their own. And these were very, very independent, tough guys with hearts of gold. As I listened to them, I realized over time, all of organized crime, what we call organized crime, it's all financial crime. The goal is to take your money from you. But I found gamblers were a different breed. They went into gambling because, well, they wanted your money. They didn't want to hurt you to get it. And most of these guys were really wonderful men. And as I got into their backgrounds, I wanted to research them. But working 40 hours a week, I tried on my days off to go to the library. I was dealing in Lake Tahoe. I'd go to the library at the University of Nevada, Reno. And I just realized there was too much data. And the Vietnam War came along, and I was one of the first people drafted, and they, under the law, the Selective Service System, when I declared as a conscientious objector, the Selective Service System had to have the FBI do an investigation of my background to see if I qualified. And when they got my background, they sat down with me and they said, normally what we do is when we draft you for 2 years as a conscientious objector, we send you to the nearest hospital to your home to clean bedpans for 2 years so that you don't benefit from this designation. But they said, you're in a very unusual position. Back then, J. Edgar Hoover was the director of the FBI. And every year he lied to the president, to the Congress, and to the American people and said there was no such thing as organized crime, so he didn't have to investigate it. And they said there's really nobody that knows how it operates, nobody from the outside who knows how it developed. You've got a background in social psychology. You know all of these gangsters and hang out with them. They said, we are giving you the option of either cleaning bedpans for 2 years or hanging out with gangsters in Las Vegas and trying to figure out what this is all about. And, of course, I opted to hang out in Vegas, so they drafted me, ordered me to work for the School of Criminology at the University of California, Berkeley, for 2 years. And I was fortunate there was a great criminologist heading it. He designed the program. I never asked any of these guys any questions that weren't at least 10 years old, so the statute of limitations protected them, and they had no reason to fear me. And when I wasn't interviewing people, I was in the University of Nevada, Las Vegas library reading old documents, newspapers, and over the course of many years, I thought I was going to finish the whole story in 2 years, but I didn't realize two things. One, the amount of data that I had to get to understand it all. But secondly, I thought I only have to get in with a few key people and they'll tell me everything. And what I didn't understand till I got into it is most of these men not only came out of illegal casino operations, but they had been in prohibition before. And the people from prohibition were the most tight-lipped people I have ever met in my whole life. They never, ever talked about their activities because they were going out to the oceans on one of the two coasts to meet freighters with large fleets of high-speed boats. Then they charged ashore trying to beat the Coast Guard and the pirates. There on the shorelines, they fill up large convoys of trucks and take them across the U.S. They had big warehouses, and they didn't want to accidentally tip their hand when they were going out to sea, when they were moving this stuff, where their facilities were. And so I learned that I had to get to each one of them. And I had a few situations where I'm sitting in someone's home or office, and I'm asking them about their partner. And, you know, this is a lifetime partner, and starting with prohibition. And I'd say, by the way, they were in this business, a legal business. What was that about? Well, a few of them not only denied they were in that business, they got so angry I backed off and said, oh, I got my information wrong, because they were about to throw me out. And I realized that they didn't even tell their closest partners and friends anything unless they were involved in the activity. So it took me almost 50 years to collect everything, and now I'm working on my third book of the combination of the history of the Nevada casino business and organized crime, because the four biggest prohibition gangs that were far bigger than anybody else, their leaderships or their associates were the ones who built the early Las Vegas Strip.
Wow. That is really an intriguing story. So, and not anyone else probably even has that experience, period, that you've had.
These guys didn't talk to anybody else, and no one's done all of that research. You know, I mean, we're talking about just enormous amounts of time. I read 157,000 old newspapers. I'm talking about in their entirety, not articles, but I'd have to go through to have all these ongoing stories to see what happened. And I read over 200,000 pages of FBI reports, collecting it and reading it and assembling it, and then taking that and turning it into interviews and tying it all together has been an enormous project, but it finally all makes sense to me.
Well, in your book, you talk about the legal ramifications of hanging out with hoodlums. What did you mean by that? What were the ramifications?
Well, I was all right as long as I was doing research. But it led, because of the knowledge I was gaining about how the business developed, how it operated, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, today offers a master's degree in casino management. I had the first course, the pioneer course in casino management in any college or university in the world, and because of that, I wrote a book called Casino Management, and I ended up going to work for the Howard Hughes Empire, who was a major tycoon in the middle of the 1900s and one of the wealthiest men in the world, and he bought and owned 7 hotel casinos in Nevada, and 2 of them were doing very poorly, and they first offered me one to see what I could do because I'd never managed or supervised anybody. And when I turned that longtime loser into a big winner, they offered me a second one. Well, I came up for licensing. And that was a very traumatic period for me because the number one reason they denied people licenses in those days was because of gangland connections. And here that was my whole life, and I didn't know what they were going to do if they barred me from working in the industry. It took away the only career I had. And if they barred me from any further contact, I couldn't go on with my research on my own time. And I didn't know what was going to happen, but I had interviewed all the key people in gaming control, the top politicians and passing the laws. So everybody knew me. Everybody knew what I was doing. And so when I went in there, I was very, very worried what my future was going to be. And they passed me without question. And when it was over, the 3 voting members who were appointed by the governor called me aside and they said, "Now we want to have the factual background of this industry in our state as much as you do, so you continue to keep your nose clean, but you continue your research. We're supporting it 100%. So I went from absolute terror what my future was to an unbelievable situation where I was able to continue to spend the rest of my life dealing with these people.
So,
and in fact, an incredible part of the story, many years later, there, a man by the name of Cy Redd created IGT, International Gaming Technology, which was by far the biggest slot machine manufacturer. And he owned a casino in Mesquite, Nevada, which is 90 miles northeast of Las Vegas towards Utah. And it had gone into bankruptcy. And he called me up and he says, "I need you to go in there for a few months and straighten this thing out for me." And I went in there and took over the operation. Well, the people that had leased it were the licensees. He wasn't licensed. I wasn't licensed. Nobody was licensed. And I was going to fill out my application. And technically, I had to. But the Gaming Control Board said, "Look, in the few months he's going to be there, we can't complete the investigation. We know everything we need to know about him." And so here, the only person in the history of the state of Nevada that was allowed to operate an unlicensed casino was the guy who spent his life hanging out with gangsters.
That is a really great story. And so, which of the, I know you met several of these mafia leaders. Which one was the most intriguing and interesting to you?
Well, the fascinating person was So you know, there was a number of fascinating guys, and they were all linked together. But probably the most colorful and relevant was Ben Siegel. Now, I didn't meet him. He was killed before my research, but his life was the most interesting for several reasons. One was he came to Nevada before any of the other hoods, and he saw the future of a Las Vegas Strip. He had a dream, and all the people that later built it had been his partners, and he promoted this idea of this lavish strip of casinos and golf courses and so on. And when he died, all these guys came in big time and put his blueprint into life. But he stood out for a couple of other reasons, and there's been a lot written about these people. It's almost all fiction. Nobody else realized what I did. Whenever I write about one of these people, I have their birth date in front of me, and I have how old they would be at every 10-year mark, because we are very different people at different ages, different value systems, different ways of reacting. And nobody else noticed, because they hadn't done serious research. They pay attention to his birth date. So you find one book after Ben Siegel after another saying that he, 3 years before Prohibition in 1920, which would have been 1917, he and Meyer Lansky had a gang in Lower East Manhattan, and there's two problems with that. One, there's five mafia gangs in New York City. The two biggest, that was their territory. And trust me, nobody else committed any type of financial crime in that area. So his little supposed little Jewish gang would have been wiped out. But what no one noticed, because they were trying, he was very close to Meyer Lansky, who was 3 years older. No one knows what Meyer Lansky did for the 3 years before Prohibition. He tells his family that he was an auto mechanic, and there's no reason to doubt that, but there's also no evidence. Well, they put them in a gang called the Bug and Meyer Gang. The problem is, Ben Siegel was 11 years old at the time, and they have him leading a gang that's knocking out the biggest mafia gangs. And even at the age when he was 14 years old. I'm trying to think. It was either 13 or 14. I don't remember. When Prohibition began, he finished grammar school and went with Meyer Lansky, and within 6 months they had the biggest Prohibition gang in America. And he was 14 at that time, which is phenomenal, because most of the guys were around 20 at the beginning of Prohibition. All these famous names, when you look at them, they weren't leaders, most of them, in the beginning, but those that became the powerhouses during the 50 years from 1920 to 1970. And here you have him at 14 years old, and when I say big, we are talking about a gang that probably brought in 75 million bottles of the finest legal liquor produced around the world every year. I mean, it was humongous. We don't know how they got the financing for the freighters, for the high-speed boats, for the convoys, but they dominated everybody. There's no one that lived during the Prohibition in gangland that said these were not the biggest. So here you have a boy at 14 totally being the biggest and most highly respected gangster in America. Interesting, the New York Times, which I read everything they had on this era, they don't even mention his name until after Prohibition because he kept a low profile. But although he started out as a shy boy who was always very polite but quiet around women, at the end of Prohibition, he moved out to Hollywood. And he lived, here they have him as this bad, tough guy blowing up at people. I've got quoted in my book, the Society Writers of Hollywood. He was, for the next 14 years, the most sought-after dinner guest by the top business people in Beverly Hills, by the top people in Hollywood, the producers, the directors, the stars. Everybody wanted him for dinner. He had a girlfriend. Well, before we get into a girlfriend, he became friends with a woman 18 years older than he was. And, of course, everyone assumes they were lovers. There's no one that knew them that felt they were anything but friends. And I understand it because my whole life I have had very close women friends, and it was just purely friendship. So that all makes sense to me. And she was the biggest party thrower in Hollywood, and her name was the Countess Dorothy DeFrazzo, and she had married a count from Italy. She was divorced at the time, and she threw a party at least once a week with all the most famous people in Hollywood. And then his girlfriend was named Virginia Hill, and she became even bigger, but instead of throwing it in her home, she threw her parties in the most famous nightclub in L.A. So several nights a week, these two women are throwing parties. He'd drop by, and then he'd head out to the four casinos. The Sunset Strip now goes all the way to the ocean, but back then it became a dirt road, and at the end of it was four illegal casinos. And he was the most sought-after person in town. He and the Countess went to every premiere. He was out every night with all the celebrities on the weekends. They'd go to the fine illegal casino in Palm Springs or the incredible racetrack and high-end casino in Tijuana. And here he lived the most glamorous life of any gangster and almost any other person, and all they have him is a crazed thug.
Wow. And have you ever thought about writing a movie script?
Oh, this thing would make an incredible movie because the people that have read my book or books and have said to me that instead of being thugs, these guys were very sophisticated. That's how they became such top business people. Some of them were the most powerful political kingmakers in the history of America. Everybody trusted them, and they said it makes far more sense to understand them from your perspective than to make them the goons that they've been made out to be. So I think it's just an incredible story. That's why I stayed with it. But, you know, cracking into that field is difficult, so if the opportunity arises, it's just awesome because, for example, you could do a two-hour movie once a month on HBO, and the material I've got, you could go five or six seasons with nothing but the pure facts.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, and that would be so powerful, you know, and people would definitely watch it because everybody's fascinated by these men and what, you know, what they were doing and how they changed America and how they created Las Vegas. And I just got back from Las Vegas meeting family and friends there, you know. I think it would make fantastic series of movies. Like you said, 1 or 2 hours, you know, every week. And it could go on and on because you have so many stories to tell. And so also you, I'm going to take a little break here, but also you talk about America's powerful street gangs and the development of the mafia. And I was wondering, if you think about this for a second while we take a break, did law enforcement know that these gangs were forming and becoming so strong and so powerful, or did they just think of them as thugs? Because, as you said, they became extremely powerful, and they weren't thugs. They were actually very intelligent, and they had a goal, and they reached their goal. And so I'm curious how the politicians and the police and law enforcers, when they began to form these gangs or mafiosos, how did they react? I mean, did they just think, well, you know, they're just thugs, you know, just young people, you know, it's not that big a deal? Or did they really believe that something big was going to come down and they were going to have to deal with it? So we're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a minute with Bill Friedman and his fabulous book, award winner, 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. So stay with us on Colombo Chronicles Live.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure, be sure to bring your appetite.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hi, we're back on Colombo Chronicles Live. We're talking to our special guest, Bill Friedman, award-winning author, casino consultant, and he's a pioneer, and he's a historian. And his book is titled 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. It's a must-read, and it would make a great, great movie series and a great movie. So, Bill, when you were doing your research in the very beginning, and this was all starting to take hold here in the good old USA, do you think that law enforcement actually thought it was going to be as big and serious as it actually became?
Unfortunately, there's a lot of very honest cops, so I don't want to do that, but it is, our laws in America are strong enough that if the police and the politicians are honest, these kinds of crimes and gangs cannot function. And that is one of the things when I say it makes sense to people. In each case, when I go through these gangs, I show how they corrupted certain key people in the police departments and the politicians and got their protection. The early gangs, one of the deals they made with politicians was most of these gangs, obviously they were in neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods. They actually took care of the needy people in their voting districts. And they became the most powerful political leaders. And they people voted for them not because of threat or what you would see in the movies. They told the people, we can get you jobs, we can get you food, we can, when you know, when you're hungry, we can get you these things, but only if our people are elected. And so they can control the people who were elected in their districts, and then in return for getting them elected, they would make a deal and say, okay, for the next 4 years I'm in office, you can have an illegal casino. In some cases, they gave them an illegal brothel, and perfectly wide open like today's casinos, but illegal, and that was their return. And in some cases, they gave them their meeting club. They gave them attorneys. They got arrested. So all of this occurs because of corrupted law enforcement. And so I show how it worked in each of these jurisdictions and who was involved. And, of course, I'm always looking for patterns, so I would have loved to have seen either the Democratic or Republican Party like Ben, the criminal party. But it turned out they were both just as awful. What would happen if one party was voted out? They would close down the casinos because that was their main form of income of all these gangs until Prohibition. They would close down the P-ported their opponent, and they would talk about law and order, and they would immediately put their own criminals in to replace them. And they were both just as awful.
So that kind of explains what's going on today in politics. So was New York and Chicago the biggies that where these gangs were forming?
Yeah, because they were the two big cities, so they were the places to plunder. Manhattan ended up, there was 24 mafia gangs in America, and five of them were in Manhattan because over half the wealth of America lived there. That was the place to be. And two of the three biggest gangs, Prohibition gangs, were based in Manhattan. And the third was based in the Midwest, and all these people ended up in Vegas, or their associates did. And then the fourth most important gang was the Chicago gang, and where the three big gangs were men of high integrity. I meant people like the partners in them were Frank Costello, Charlie Luciano, Joe Adonis. They were the biggest political powers in New York City. If you want anything done, you went to them. And they didn't have their hand out. They helped everybody, and everybody helped them. But they were, you know, not just important. They were the biggest. In Brooklyn, it was Adonis. In Manhattan, it was Costello and Luciano. And, of course, that was a Democratic town. Then Capone, he was kept in power by the Republicans in Chicago. Now, he and his group were completely different. They were as vicious and murderous as they have been made out to be. It's hard to believe that those four groups could have become friends, but they partnered throughout Prohibition. They partnered in legal businesses, always together. But those four groups were unique, and they became important in Vegas because almost every gang in America came out of a poor neighborhood, and they were always one nationality. And because when immigrants came here, they went where people knew their culture. In some cases, if they didn't speak English, they knew their language. And so they were all one group. And when Prohibition ended, they just kept in their neighborhood and got a lot smaller because Prohibition was a huge income source. The four big gangs I'm talking about, they all had in their membership and leadership all kinds of nationalities. Capone was Italian, but his number one man was Jewish. And because of this, when Prohibition ended and they lost all this income, they opened very high-end casinos across America that were more elegant than anything in Vegas today. I mean, these places were just for the very most wealthy, and they opened them across the country because they knew how to get along with everybody else. Those groups that just had one nationality weren't comfortable in other areas, so they opened up across America, and no one but those four gangs did. They may have had a casino in their own territory, but not one other gang expanded. So you've got Costello, who's in New York. You've got Meyer Lansky in Miami. Costello's also in New Orleans. And we can go on and on with how they branched out all over the country, and they had these incredible casinos, and they were always fronted by the finest nightclub or restaurant in the city. And in the back room was the gambling after you either went in for dinner or entertainment. And so they knew everybody at the top of the line. Costello owned the Copacabana, which was the most famous and glamorous nightclub in America. It was the place to be. And, of course, it had the top, top stars at the moment. And it was interesting. Bobby Darin, when he was a young man, and he was turning out one rock and roll hit after another, he told his friends, he said, "The day I walk out on the Copa stage, I will know I'm a star." That was the ultimate.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. I mean, how exciting. And that's when everybody wore suits and tuxes and long dresses and dressed up to go out, you know, not like today. They dress down.
It's so different. It's unbelievable. My parents brought me to Vegas the first two times. I was 12 and 14 in the middle of the 1950s, and at that age, I could not go to a show with them in the evening if I didn't have a suit on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I wear a suit. There was a great nightclub in San Francisco where we celebrated all the family parties, and they took me there from the age of 7 whenever there was a family function, and I had to have a suit on.
Yeah, I think that dress codes are good, you know, and, you know, because people are not wearing anything or very little today, and it's really dressing down, and I think, you know, even my daughters, you know, and when they look at these old classic movies, they are just so excited because of the clothing and the way they dress so elegant. They just get excited about it, you know. They wish we could dress like that, you know, when we go out. You know, I mean, it's so beautiful. And unfortunately, Bill, you every time you're on my show, the time flies. And darn it. And it's so intriguing. I just could listen and listen and listen. So we're going to have you back because you're going to have to tell us about your upcoming book that you're about to write about World War II and how it ties into all of these mafia organizations and 30 illegal years to the Strip. And now's your time to shine. Tell us anything you want about how they can get your books and any messages or social media contacts you have.
Okay, well, I've got a website, Bill Friedman, Friedman, author, AUTHOR.com. It has all the information about me. It takes you to my books at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. for the printed copy, all the major retailers of e-books carry them, and I've got a blog there that keeps up with my activities as I develop new projects.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being on Columbo Chronicles Live, and we'll talk to you again and find out what you're up to and think about writing those movie scripts. I truly think that you have a great opportunity there. And we'll talk to you again soon. God bless you, Bill.
God bless you, and thank you.
You're so welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Bill Friedman has left the building, and you've got to get his book, 30 Illegal Years Through the Strip. It's so fascinating. I mean, I could just talk to Bill forever and ever and just listen and learn. And I want to thank you for joining us, especially all those in other countries. My goodness, Russia and China and the Netherlands and Germany and, gosh, there's so many countries here. Thank you so much for listening. And I don't know what time it is in your area, but God bless you. And, you know, we're praying for peace around the world because we're all brothers and sisters. And so thanks for tuning in to Columbo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. We're here for you. And hope you're entertained, hope you're educated, and hope you enjoy everything and everyone that brings their expertise to Columbo Chronicles Live. So God bless you, and God bless America.
Rose Columbo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Columbo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Columbo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Columbo Chronicles.